greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I am head control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. Limark Technical Net has been going strong for over 44 years now. Every Sunday night at around 8 o'clock, we sit in front of our radios, and we chat with each other, we educate each other, we learn from each other, hopefully we're entertained by each other. And I thank you once again for joining me tonight at 8 p.m. when we try and do this all over again. Let me drop for a second, and I will tell you the usual links. If you want to reach me via email, that would be either for what we used to call mailbag questions. Those are questions that usually are asked on the technical net, but if you're not in radio distance, you can send it to me through email, and if it sounds interesting, we can cover it. Or if you have a TechNet puzzle, we're always in search of interesting technical puzzles that help to stimulate discussion. Or if you have a topic that you're knowledgeable about that has come up in the news recently and you want to share the wisdom, let me know, and we'll put some time aside for you to do a short discourse on that technical aspect. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and have him take a look at some space or NASA-related story and review it for you. Of course, you can directly contact him. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com, and my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Also, I cut and paste a whole bunch of interesting YouTubes and articles that I see throughout the week, and I post them every Sunday night, and you can take a look at them whenever you want. They'll be up for the foreseeable future, so if you have a bout of insomnia in a couple of days or a couple of weeks or a couple of months, you can just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to my link page. We have a chat room available. Sometimes it's busy, sometimes it ain't. You can get to it by typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. Also, we have a audio stream of the technical net on the internet. So if you're not able to raise the repeater, you can use anything that has a browser on it. Just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you an audio stream of the Glen Oaks repeater. And I keep it live the rest of the week, so in case you're ever curious what's going on in Glen Oaks and you don't have a radio on you, just again type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you the audio stream. And I always like to remind people that MyKC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv, and it is archives of the Limark Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of hams that have been on the TechNet throughout the many years and either moved away or unfortunately passed away and became a silent key. Let me drop for a second, then I will return and tell you what I got planned for tonight. Okay, I have a couple of subjects I'd like to cover before the questions and comments segment. Shouldn't take us more than 5-10 minutes. If anyone wants to respond, they're certainly, it's fine by me if you respond to the two subjects I pretty much have to tell at the top of this technical net, and we will go to the science and amateur radio technology and such segment. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion, I would prefer if the first few are amateur radio related, because this is an amateur radio net. But, we will try to discuss any subject in science and technology that you wish to bring up tonight. That should take us, hopefully, to about 10:15. Paul will join us, WS2N, with the SpaceNet report. That should take us to about 11 p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well. So that's the plan if everything works right and continues to work right, and I don't fall off of All-Star The repeater doesn't blow a fuse or any other strange thing. So we'll see what happens tonight. Let me drop for a second, and I will tell you what I wanted to tell you at the top of the technical net. KC2GS. First, I want to recount something. I must have told you other times before, but most recently I had yet another example of it. I have two pieces of software that I have used for many, many, many years, and that gets updated every so often. When I get a notification that the software has an update, I usually, rather than wait a long time, just kind of update it. So one of those two is a very mom-and-pop shop. I assume that they have the number of employees in that business you could probably count on one hand. And the update broke something. Actually, what it is designed to do is record LIMARC using voice activation, and when there are pauses or when there are absence of transmissions, it just goes into standby and it appends the audio for each day, so that at the end of the day, I have the appended audio for the entire day. So the new update, unfortunately, lost the ability to do that, to append it. So it fragmented it into every single time there was a pause on the repeater. It stopped recording and started a fresh recording with a very, very small file. So at the end of the day, I would have hundreds of little fragments of audio file. I contacted the developer. He didn't think that was happening. I showed him some screen recordings of it happening, and the next day he sent me a patch that fixed it completely. So moral of the story, if you have an involved small business doing software, they're very responsive. Let me drop for a sec. Second case is Apple Computer. You might be aware of that. It's a rather large company. I think it's worth trillions of dollars at this point. I've lost track. Nevertheless, they have something called iTunes for Windows, in which I still kind of use it to download podcasts that I listen to and play them at my leisure. They used to delete podcasts that I listened to and not show them on the screen anymore to clutter the screen. The new iTunes update broke that feature, and so I have an almost infinite number of podcasts ghosted on the screen, cluttering up the screen and make it difficult to figure out, what I've listened to and what I haven't listened to. So it took a while to figure out how to contact them. When I did, they didn't seem to understand English or anything because, I started off saying it was iTunes for Windows, and they kept talking about my iPhone for some strange reason. Nevertheless, eventually, then they asked for a copy of the warning screen. I said, there's no warning screen. It just ghosts all of my old podcasts and refuses to make them disappear. I think I finally got it across to her, and she kind of said that, well, this was probably not the first time someone's complained about that, so I shouldn't worry, but she let people know. So my assumption is I'm going to get absolutely nothing done for another 6 months. And eventually, in 6 months, they'll update the application, and hopefully they'll fix it. But I'm not going to hold my breath and wait for an email with a patch like I was able to do with the other one. So the moral of the story is, if you have any option between buying software from a major multi-trillion dollar company or a mom-and-pop organization, all things being equal, consider the mom-and-pop organization, because they're much more likely to actually talk to you. So that's the moral of that story. Any comments, feel free. Okay, I guess no one has any comment one way or the other. The next and last thing that I just wanted to share with everyone is a new problem that I've never heard of before, and unfortunately it happened to me. Thursday morning at around 3 a.m. in the morning, unbeknownst to me, because I was busy sleeping, I get an email from Verizon that says, as per your request, I didn't make any requests, as per your request, we are taking your phone number landline and disconnecting it and transferring it to another provider. Have a nice day. Well, like I said, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm not reading emails, thank God. So Thursday, I go over to my telephone. I notice that there's no dial tone. I can't use my phone anymore. I didn't read my email yet, so I didn't quite know what was going on. Eventually, I hunt down Verizon, and they kind of tell me, no problem. It was apparently transferred to T-Mobile. But no problem. All that I have to do is give them what they call the transfer PIN, which is the four-digit number that they give whoever somehow got my phone number moved, and they could move it back. Well, I tell them I didn't ask to have it moved, so no one gave me a PIN number. Oh, okay. Can I have the account in T-Mobile that it was transferred to? So I hit my head against the wall a few times and go back to the phone and say, look, I had nothing to do with transferring it, so I don't know where it was transferred to. You know better than I, because I didn't even know it was T-Mobile. So they kind of told me, okay, well, then we got to go the hard way. And, again, this was Thursday. They said, we'll probably be able to get you back your phone number by about Monday. So, have a great weekend, and thank you for using Verizon. So that was the end of that. So it's now a thing that people can steal your phone numbers. Not your phone itself, but your phone number. Any comments? Yeah, I never heard of this before, Jeff. I'm sorry, I mean, I read all these things, and I kind of keep up on the scams. But I was a little concerned that this might be some kind of identity theft, except that it's a landline. So it doesn't do SMS, so it doesn't do authentication. So they can't get into any of my accounts by having them send an SMS code to a phone number that I never listed on any account, because it's a landline and doesn't work that way. And I just to be on the safe side, I went to my financial account to see if there was any activity. There was none. So I don't even know why someone would do this under those circumstances. Two people doubled. Toss a coin, and the guy who got heads, repeat.
A2STP.
Yes, Chris.
Hi, Roy. That actually, that has been going on for like 30 years. That's a very old trick. And there's various different reasons they do it. Generally, they're trying to get your number, so someone is getting paid commission to move phone numbers onto T-Mobile. They get their $8 or whatever it is to move a line. A bigger thing that occurs is they move corporation phone numbers. So we had it happen to us, where I used to work. 800 number was moved to a competitor. So we had 10,000 phone calls a day coming in there, suddenly going to a competitor. So that's been going on a very long time. There's absolutely no security on moving lines other than knowing an account number. So generally they can steal a bill, steal an email, somehow get your account number. That's all you need.
Okay, I talked to the Verizon person, and they were really terribly helpful. The only thing I think they could do is offer to change my PIN number. So I don't know if the magic was the PIN number or the account number or what it was, but I changed my PIN number for the heck of it. And, you know, like I said, my biggest concern was the possibility of being spoofed for one of my financial apps, and I checked to see if there was any activity, and there wasn't. So I don't know. It's just another annoyance. And, you know, the fact that it takes 4 or 5 days, I'm being optimistic that they're going to be true to their word and have it back, you know, have my number back for me by tomorrow sometime. But, geez, that's a big flaw, I would imagine.
Troy, there's a third part to this, and that's even a worse part. Is if I think it's your cell phone, and if it is, if they transfer your cell phone and they get a, you know, they buy their own phone and put that number to that phone. If they have any of your financial info and they send you the text with the code to get in, they got it, and they can steal some stuff. So they could be in the starting process of getting into your financials somehow. So be careful and make sure that gets transferred right away.
WBQKWC?
Yes.
Okay. Good evening, Roy. Is it possible that they're just looking to use your phone number because of its reputation? There are so many services out now, no more robo, or even built into your phone, there are call blockers. So essentially, they just want to use a phone number that's not on a blacklist, and that's the reason they just want to use it.
Okay, I guess that's possible, but I'm sure there are far easier ways. I'm told that there are internet services that spoof telephone lines, and you can give it whatever number that you want to give it, and all kinds of much more flexible and you know ways of doing it. If you do it to the average guy, I would assume within a day or two he realizes something's been screwed up, and so it's a kind of a cat and dog type of a thing where, you know, in not too many days, I mean, I will be astounded and amazed at the incompetence of Verizon if they contact me and they say, well, we just can't do it, so we'll give you a new number. But, you know, who knows? Like I said, it's not back yet. And as to Chris, it's my landline, so there's no SMS attached to it, and it's not a security phone number that I've submitted to any of my financial services. So, and I've gone in and looked just to be on the safe side. So there's very little risk. If they had done it to a cell phone, yeah, but this is a landline.
Gotcha. Okay, so it's probably, like I said, they're just getting the commission on moving the line. They get $8-$10 to move a line, and you move 100 of them, you know, do math. They make money that way. It's ridiculous, but that's the world we live in today. K2SD.
Okay. Like I said, I don't know if there's any way to guarantee that that'll never happen again, because I don't quite know what the mechanism was that they did it. I guess eventually when I have the patience and the time, I'll sit down and Google it and then YouTube it and see if I can see if there's a consensus out there. Again, this is the first time I ever heard of someone stealing a phone number. I mean, a personal phone number. I'm sure a lot of people do a lot of screwy things with businesses, but I don't know. It's a weird world we're living in, all I can say.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Could the motivation be for somebody that's putting out constant calls to, you know, for scam calls, but they need a phone number? Now, you know, if you keep getting the same phone number from, you know, from the same person, eventually you're not never going to answer or listen to it. But suppose that phone number next week is coming in on another phone number. You might think, well, you know, maybe I'll answer this one, and so on and so forth. You know, like, you know, we always get this one call. It's a scam for insurance, and every time it comes in, it's a different phone number. Sometimes it's 212, sometimes it's 516. The numbers just always constantly keep changing. So I think maybe that's one of the motivations for these people, if they can get those numbers back to you.
Yeah, you don't actually need to do that because, unfortunately, when they first set up caller ID, they had no means to authenticate it. So you can spoof any caller ID that you want to. You just send a signal along with the phone call, and it'll say Microsoft Corporation, it'll say Apple Corp, it'll say IRS, it'll say Social Security. I've gotten all those types of phone calls registered on my caller ID, on my landline through the years. You know, sometimes I've noticed where they were too stupid to set up the caller ID field, so it was just a random alphanumeric array that wasn't even a phone number or a proper word. So that, you know, nowadays, you know, unless you're really primitive, it's so easy to do it relatively free. Again, there are services that allow people to run fake phone lines. They just feed into the mainstream. It starts off as a voice over internet protocol telephone call, and then they just modify all the preamble to it and, you know, make it come from the White House if they wanted to.
AD2DU.
Yes, Alex.
I couldn't get to the radio earlier. The craziest thing you said is you're using iTunes for Windows. That is my least favorite piece of software of my entire life. AD2DU.
Okay, well, I think it's the least favorite of Apple as well, and it's not great, but through the years, I have figured out things to do that I just can't seem to do with other podcast players on Windows. I have set hotkeys, because there's a separate discontinued program for iTunes hotkeys. So I've been able to run scripts where I kind of set up a dead man switch, you know, bad name for anything, for podcasting. So what I do is I'll set up a podcast to play for me, and if I fall asleep in about 10, 15 minutes, it'll go on pause and stay there. But if not, if I'm still awake, I'll hit a button, and that'll give me another 15 minutes. And I can just keep doing that until I fall asleep. I can't do that yet with any other podcasting software on Windows. They don't have a hotkey where you don't have to put the window in focus in order to get the scripts to do the things that I need to do. If you know of any podcast that has global hotkeys, I'd love to hear about it.
I thought the only reason anyone used that software was to install pirated content onto their iPhone, because you used to have to, you couldn't, iPhone would never mount as a drive like Android would, but everyone just uses their phone, and there's just a function for a sleep timer, I think is what people do now.
Yeah, but there's no way to re-trigger it is the problem. I've done that before, but what unfortunately happens is when the sleep timer times out, instead of me just poking a button someplace, I have to pick up the cell phone, light it up, make sure that it recognizes my face, go to the timer, and hit the play again, which is a big pain in the backside. It's much nicer to just kind of in the middle of the dark, I know where the button is, I press it once, and I got another 15 minutes.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the iPhone does the sleep timer alert trigger on the lock screen now. See, there's a button that says extend 15 minutes.
Not quite sure. I mean, I'll look at it again, but it still requires to me a lot more effort. You know, I mean, again, you got to grab the phone and shake it or something to light it up, and then focus in on where on the display is the magic extend 15 minutes. Again, you know, in the middle of the night in the darkness, I could feel my magic external USB button much more easily.
I mean, you just have a six-monitor computer next to the bed, it sounds like. The phone has to be easier than this. But, 82 to you.
No, I just have a Lenovo laptop next to the bed. I have some iPads around, and I have the iPhone. But, you know, I'm trying to figure out a way of doing it with my eyes closed, because it's a lot easier to kind of slowly fade off into sleep, the less that you do every 15 minutes to maintain the audio feed, the better to be. And I haven't been able to come up with a eyes-closed method with anything other than iTunes. Again, the problem is, you know, I could find other podcast-playing applications for Windows, but they don't have global hotkeys, which is what I ultimately need.
Got it. Well, let us know if you figure it out. 82 to you.
Okay. I'll share the wealth. As I always do. We'll see what happens. But I'm sure that, you know, in 6 months, Apple will have a new revision. And I guess, you know, 50-50 chance they'll fix the cluttered display of ghosted podcasts and such. But until then, I guess I'm going to have to live with clutter. Anyway, any other comments before we move on to the main segment? Okay, I've shared with you my little situations for this past week. We're open for business. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics for tonight, hopefully the first few should be amateur radio related, but once again, we're open to any science and technology discussions. So if anyone's out there with any of those, hit that push to talk, give me your call sign, give me your first name, and whether it's amateur radio related or not.
And to Exxon, after everybody.
Less recognized. Anyone else want to put their name on the list for tonight? Keep in mind, once again, that every so often we have some gentleman who wants his money back because we're not talking about the subject that he wants us to talk about. And yet, usually those guys don't really come and give us any subject. They just sit back and wait to complain. So if you're not part of the solution, you become part of the problem. So with that in mind, once again, if anyone has any subjects, topics for discussion, what have you, questions related to amateur radio or other types of science and technology, please give us your name and your call sign.
KC2SHO.
Yes, John. I assume you fixed that problem you had.
Negative. I'm still waiting on... well, hopefully I've got a receiver that will be en route on Monday and programmed sometime after it arrives. But anyway, no, I'm coming in to you this evening on the Transceed software for Mac. So hopefully I sound okay.
Yeah, you sound fine.
Okay, great. Was there someone before me, or are you just chatting, or you want my question? It's science-related, but there might be a ham radio component to it, only because I usually have a ham radio with me when it's happening.
Well, I mean, the person before you is Wes, and the way Wes wanted to do it was after the other people. Because he usually has a long list of subjects that he likes to go over. So you could certainly go first.
All right. It might be kind of silly, but it's something that I've always wondered about. Being an avid bicyclist, or you don't even have to be that to experience this. Whenever the weather gets cooler, I feel that I'm breathing more exhaust from cars. So the cars that are going by, the exhaust gases seem to linger more right around, you know, me or whoever's around. So why is that? I would think as weather gets cooler, you got hot air coming out of the car, it would rise faster, although it probably changes right back to ambient temperature very quickly. But What's the reason? Is it perception only, or am I really breathing more exhaust gases when the cars are passing me in cooler weather, and especially winter time?
WA2VSM.
Yes, Bill.
Yes, good evening, everybody. Cold air is denser. I think that's the answer.
Okay, but I don't know why denser air should. I guess what you're implying is with denser air there is less diffusion. I don't know where one leads to the other though.
Well, also just remember something: cold air falls and hot air rises. So there's many dynamics in place, but. I mean, I cycle, I find the same thing. But clearly, I mean, I've smelt it with other types of exhausts and what have you, smoke. And if you ever see a fire, the hot air causes smoke to billow upward, and if it's cold air or something, it tends more to be dense and fall downward. We can't see this, but clearly, the density of the air has something to do with it. I'm sure Jim, VHD, who's a fire captain, could probably shed more information on that, Troy.
Okay, but, you know, I mean, my problem is, okay, so the exhaust rises faster when it's cold, so why would you sense it more when it's rising? I would assume that it would eventually rise far above your nose. So again, I agree with you about the density, but I just don't see the scientific correlation between low density fumes being able to be smelled worse in the winter than in the summer. I do have a theory which I'll share, but I just. If you want to extend or explain why the density in winter would make you notice it more as opposed to notice it less.
Yeah, you made a mistake. You said a comment that cold air rises, cold air falls, not rises. So if you think about air, cold air falling in respect to hot air, which rises because of the temperature of the air itself, that has a lot to do with density. Cold air definitely will cause whatever is within the air to start to fall, whereas hot air will rise. Just think of any type of hot air balloon. Balloons go up with the hot air, and they come down with cold.
I didn't say that cold air rises. I said hot air, the exhaust fumes rise. So why would the exhaust fumes rising in the winter cause you to smell the exhaust fumes more than if it doesn't rise and just stays, maybe a foot around the exhaust the pipe area? The other person, you wanted to say something else?
Yes, WB2KW3. The gasoline companies use different formulations in the cold weather than in the warm weather. Is it possible that the byproducts of combustion with the different additives for the fall season, you're more sensitive to them and notice them more?
Okay, I mean, that's a possibility. Yes, Jim?
I don't have a definitive answer, but I have a pretty good theory to explain that circumstance. The one of the largest environmental impacts that there is on the planet, having to do with temperature fall and rise and heat islands and whatnot, is pavement. the pavement that you're driving over has more influence on the air currents than your cars, your fuel, and all that other stuff. There's a tremendous upwelling of air that happens, let's say, on a street or a highway from the solar energy gained into the pavement, and of course, there's a tremendous rising of the air column in that vicinity. So in the summertime, the air on the street is going upward, drawing those fumes away from you. As things cool off and the sun gets lower on the horizon, the pavement is much cooler, and that effect is greatly diminished. I would think that's at least a piece of the puzzle. KD2VHD.
Okay, I mean, ultimately, the answer is probably going to be multiple factors, that it isn't just one thing. I think also what might be affecting it is the general average humidity of the different seasons. In the summer, the humidity is much higher. There's more moisture content. I would assume that might act as a mild blockage for petrochemical compounds diffusing quickly to the bicycler, and in the middle of the winter, the humidity drops a lot, and so there's far less humidity in the atmosphere, and a little bit less resistance for the aerosols, the hydrocarbon aerosols and such, to diffuse a wee bit more significantly before it kind of diffuses, you know, upward where no one is smelling it. So I think one of the factors might be the difference in humidity.
KWC, don't know if you caught my comment, but there are different formulations for the winter and summer. So byproducts of combustion might be different.
Yeah, I heard, Ken. I mean, that's a possibility. I don't know if I think it's. I don't know exactly how significant the formulation changes for summer and winter are in places like New York, as opposed to, you know, if you're up in Minnesota or something where there's regularly sub-zero temperatures. But yeah, that might be a factor as well. Like I said, most likely it's not going to be a this is the reason why. It's going to be these are the five reasons why.
Agreed.
Just remember, hot air rises, cold air falls. Very elementary.
Yeah, it's elementary, but I don't think it really has any effect on that, like I said. Because the hot air always rises. So, and if it rises, it rises above your nose, and you don't really smell it that much. So, yeah, I don't think it's purely the fact that in cold weather, the temperature differential of exhaust causes, a force on the aerosols to rise above in the sky. Then you're not smelling it on your bicycle that much, to me, at least.
Just remember, the exhaust becomes part of the air. Cold air is denser. You can have more particulate and all other things in colder, denser air than hot. I'm sorry. Yeah, the cold air is denser, so I think that may not be the end, but certainly might be a factor for it.
Perhaps, but, you know, like I said, it kind of would explain, it could more easily explain the exact opposite, that the differential between the cold weather and the hot exhaust would mean the hot exhaust would rise faster.
Yeah, but the point is, the discussion was about in cold air, so it wouldn't rise faster. You're missing the point, I believe.
No, I think I got the point. The point is, when it's colder, the temperature differential coming from the exhaust is greater. And so the difference between the buoyancy of the cold air in the weather and the hot exhaust is going to cause a greater force for the exhaust to elevate, to go up because of that differential.
Okay, well, Jim can tell you, but, you know, you're talking about a finite amount of exhaust in an infinite atmosphere. So I I don't see that whatsoever.
Okay, well, then you don't see it. And it's not an infinite amount of atmosphere. It's a lot of atmosphere, but it's not an infinite amount of atmosphere. And like I said, to me, it doesn't really work much because if it's just a matter of the general temperature, if the general temperature is the same, because it's a real hot day in Arizona, say, as the exhaust coming out of your pipe, then there's not going to be a lot of lift to the exhaust. And so it will probably be closer to a bicycler's nose. So an answer that kind of solves the problem in one direction and anti-solves it in the other isn't really a great answer to me, but it may be part of the equation.
Okay, just remember density there and temperature there.
Someone threw out their call sign. You want to try again?
Yeah, John, make sure I have it.
Yeah, we hear you, John.
Okay, the diffusion thing is interesting. That's definitely something to think about. I like that. And well, if you think about, I've seen it done where someone, say, for example, blows a puff of cigarette smoke out in the air, and someone who has a mister with a very fine spray will spray it at that cloud, and you will see the cloud kind of disappear as the molecules, I guess, are attracted to or attaching to the water molecules. So that's kind of interesting, and maybe there's some validity there. The density thing is interesting, like maybe it's just not diffusing as quickly, not so much the temperature, the delta T, I guess you'd call it, but because, you know, I'm sure that exhaust reaches ambient temperature quite quickly. Anyone who stands behind a car in the winter knows that you got to be pretty close to get any warmth, you know, from that exhaust. So anyway, and the mixture thing is interesting, too, but it's also true with diesel. So it doesn't matter which fuel it is, gasoline or diesel, the effect seems to be the same or at least similar.
It'd be interesting if you have an opportunity to test out a day that for some weird reason, I guess right after a rain, where the relative humidity is rather high, but the ambient temperature is still rather low. Just to see if that alone has any kind of effect on the situation.
Yeah, and a further thought is that, you know, here in New Mexico lately, you know, we'll have, like, pretty much high 40s or low 50-degree mornings and 80-degree days. So the temperature difference between night and day is pretty crazy here sometimes, more so than anywhere I've ever been before. So there are days when I ride my bike up in the morning and it's very obvious, and then riding home when it's, you know, 80 or 70 degrees, you can't notice it at all. Of course, I'm also going uphill on the way to work where everybody's throttled down, so the effect is even stronger.
Okay, well, you know, like we've been discussing back and forth, there's probably multiple factors and a whole mess of factors we haven't even plugged into this because we're just kind of talking about the general situation.
Okay, I won't beat a dead horse. Okay, C2SHO, thanks for that.
Okay, thanks for adding this to the equation. It gave us an opportunity to talk about diffusion and humidity and buoyancy and densities and temperature and all kinds of fun stuff. So thank you, John. Anyone else with any questions or comments or subjects before we move back to the first person on the list?
KD2 to you.
Yes, Alex.
I just want to see if you could explain in layman's terms, like automatic gain control on, I'm using the 7300, and when you use high and when you use low.
Okay, well, I mean, automatic gain control is a feedback mechanism that adjusts the amplification factor dependent upon the signal strength. If it reads a low signal strength, the feedback mechanism boosts the amplification. If it perceives a loud signal, it will lower the amplification gain signal. And the idea is to kind of even out the highs and lows so that you don't have to manually adjust the gain, which I still have to do because these things are very imperfect. As far as when to use it low and when to use it high, we've had this discussion before on the technical net. I have tended to default to using a fast. Actually, it's more of a fast, medium, and slow in which it adjusts the response timing. I usually set it fast. I believe people who are more inclined to play with CW are more likely to set it for slow or medium. I'll ask Paul, because I seem to remember the discussion for not having a fast high gain, something to do with CW. So, Paul, am I remembering correctly?
I have my AGC always... always on when I'm on CW. You know, I want the quickest response possible. So, yeah, I remember that discussion about a year ago. Back to you.
Okay. I mean, personally, again, I'm sure there are people who will disagree with me that for very good reason. I find generally that a fast attack rate automatic gain is the best setting for me. I set the levels at just below where the background noise is starting to annoy me. So, you know, because if you crank up the gain all the way, you crank up both the signal and the noise, and sometimes the noise can just fatigue people. So, but I still find that I've never come across an automatic gain circuit that's perfect. I've still had to ride an automatic to ride a gain setting. Even when the AGC was working pretty good.
So in something like FT8 or a digital mode where you just want more of the signal because the computer is going to decode it, what do you use?
I generally try to set almost nothing on something like FT8. Most digital algorithms tend to prefer that the circuits are in kind of manipulating the signal on the fly. They usually are pretty good at auto-correcting, and matter of fact, my SDR has a digi setting that I use for things like FT8, which kind of shuts down the AGC and the equalizers and all the other little modifiers, and just kind of gives a naked signal onto the detector.
I think on the 7300, unless I'm mistaken, you can only do low, middle, or high. There's no off.
Oh, okay. Well, then I would probably set whatever needs to be set in neutral. They don't have a mode for it's either single sideband, amplitude modulated, or frequency modulated. There's no kind of just data setting. Again, I've been spoiled by my Flex 6700, I guess.
I think there's an FT8 preset. I don't think I have it set properly. AD2DU.
Okay. I mean, you know, if you have to go with the things that are really single sideband settings, I would just try and get them to the most neutral setting imaginable. And because usually the algorithms are rather sophisticated, and they tend to autocorrect for all kinds of things. So I wouldn't overly manipulate the received signal for a digital algorithm means of transmission.
Makes sense. Thank you for the info. AD2DU.
WS2N.
You're welcome. Paul, yes?
I'm not sure, you know, about the 7300, the sensitivity of those settings. I just have the two settings for the older Kenwood 440, you know, so it's either on or off. But there is a noticeable difference, you know, like if you go over CW and you look at that meter and, you know, you toggle that switch back and forth, and you can see, you know, that the response time is much quicker. Now, if you listening to slow CW, you know, it really doesn't matter. But once you get into, if you're listening to high speeds, then it really does help to click that on. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, I'm just wondering how that would affect something like FT8 algorithms. I mean, those things are able to detect signals below the noise floor, which still kind of confuses me a little bit.
That might have something to do with maybe the human hearing for something like CW is going to be different than, you know, FT8, what's going on with that. But I don't know. I've never worked FT8. And when I did PSK31, I left it off. I did not have the automatic gain control on. I only use that with the CW. Back to you.
Yeah, FT8 uses all kinds of computer tricks. They repeat the signal, and they have error correction bits. So I think a lot of that, I mean, it slows things down to molasses. The symbol rate is abysmal, but, you know, you get to be able to communicate with people all over the world on relatively low power. But redundancy and error correction are the two major weapons that the algorithm uses to get away with perceiving signals that we can't hear because they're below the noise floor. But it happens all the time, and I guess that's why FT8 is so popular, and is always popular. Whenever I go and wander by the FT8 band, it's always buzzing away. So people haven't gotten tired of it at all. So that's good. I don't know how good JS8 call is. JS8 call is basically FT8. Someone took the open source algorithm and extended the text field so that you could have a short conversation. It's still a very slow short conversation, but it's longer than FT8, where it's just a signal report and some other ID material. You can actually say hello, how are you on JS8 call. Okay, this is AC2GS. Anyone else with any ham-related questions out there, please hit that push to talk and give me your ID and your first name.
All right, one more point about the 7300.
Yeah, sure, Paul.
I've never used it, but I wonder if you would have to go into the menu to make those changes. You know, that would drive me crazy if I had to do that. I don't know if there's a button right in the front of the rig. You know, on mine, it's right in the front. So, you know, I just push it. You know, I toggles in, toggles out, you know, which I like. But if I had to go into a menu, that would drive me crazy. I mean, I would do it, you know, because, you know, I'm on CW a lot, so I would definitely leave that on once I got off sideband. Back to you.
Okay, Alex, I'm not familiar that much with the 7300. Is there a push button for the gain control settings, or is it a menu setting?
There's push buttons for preamp, notch, noise blanker, and noise reduction. There's no AGC, but there's a function button on the bottom that brings up all the quick hot settings, so a whole page with all those, with Vox, signal processing, compression, all that. So it's two clicks to adjust. It's nothing crazy. I think ICOM radios have the best UI right now versus the others from what I hear. 82 to you.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Alex. Yeah, my Flex is all kind of computer surface control, so it's just a matter of clicking a field on the screen and changing the AGC from fast to medium to slow and setting the trigger settings and such. So, you know, if people don't like the computer screens, then I'm sure they'd hate this, but I find it very easy. So that answers your question, Paul.
Very good. Good to know. Yeah, I wouldn't be afraid to get that radio. That sounds good.
Okay, very good. Paul doubled with someone else. I didn't catch the call sign. If you could throw it out again.
KD2MZ, are we ready? I have a question.
We're ready.
Excellent. Thank you. KD2MZ. I am currently experimenting with 160 meters. I am currently using a 9-to-1 onion with a 1-to-1 onion common mode isolator. And I'm wondering, and I'm just still experimenting with it, the optimal length of my radiator wire and counterpoise.
Okay, I assume you're basically using an ANFET, and it sounds like you're using a random non-resonant. If it was a half-wave resonant, you would probably have more of a 49-to-1 or a 64-to-1. With a 9-to-1, that's usually the type of a balun transforming impedance of a non-resonant. And, you know, I mean, there are endless pages on the Internet of people's, you know, mystic measurements for what's the best non-resonant measurement length for given different wavelengths. Have you kind of done a Google search for that?
Yes, I have. And I've been getting different results, 135 foot or greater, some 121 foot, et cetera, et cetera. Anyone have any experience with the 9-to-1, correct, random length, non-resonant type of antenna? And they never seem to mention about the counterpoise. So that's why I'm, anybody with any experience?
Okay, we will throw it out to the audience. I have not really worked with any ANFETs. Counterpoises are always a problem. You can start an argument on 75 meters by asking anyone how many counterpoises, how many radials you would need, say, on a ground-mounted vertical, or the length of them, and everyone has their own opinion, and most of them are not the same. So I'd be willing to bet that if, say, you know, three people come on the repeater, they will give you three different good lengths to try. Unfortunately, what I've kind of perceived is it's kind of trial and error. And, you know, wire isn't that expensive, so it's not a big loss. Try and get the longest piece of wire that you can put someplace in your environment. See how it works. See how well it tunes with your, because you're going to need an antenna tuner, and if it doesn't seem to work for you, you could always shorten it a little bit and retest until you find that length that you find the best compromise. But I'll open it for the discussion. If anyone out there has any familiarity with non-resonant NFEDs that should work for 160 meters, please feel free to hit that push to talk and offer your insight to us all.
K2SCP Mobile.
Yes, Chris.
So I have I use a multi-band NFED antenna. And I'm no expert on it, but I can tell you I spoke at length with the engineer that designs them. He has his own company and sells them. And I had a question about that exact thing. whether I should put the counterpoise on it or not. His website was kind of unclear on it, so I was talking to him about it, and he said, generally speaking, a counterpoise will bring in more noise, but it can have some positive effects. So after he told me that, I tried it, and he was right. My noise level went up slightly, but absolutely noticeable. I didn't notice any other benefits, and I don't remember what he said those benefits.